What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Supreme Court announced today that Justice William Rehnquist has thyroid cancer and had a tracheotomy on Saturday. Although he should be back on the bench next week at 80 years of age, many wonder how long the Chief Justice's tenure will last. And he's not the eldest member of the court. Justice John Paul Stevens is 84. Two more of the High Court's justices, O'Connor and Ginsburg, are in their 70s, and everyone's been around for a long time. The nine members of the Rehnquist Court have served together for longer than the members of any Supreme Court since 1823. The next president is almost certain to appoint at least one justice, and maybe several. And in American life, Supreme Courts matter. Whether George Bush or John Kerry is appointing new justices could swing the law of the land decisively on a number of issues, from abortion to states' rights. The stakes are high, the consequences both weighty and intimate. Tonight on Point, the presidential election and the dawn of a new high court. We will begin with the latest on Chief Justice Rehnquist's surgery and reaction in Washington. Vivica Novak covers the court for Time magazine and joins me now. Vivica, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you.
So what do we know about how the Chief Justice is recovering from his trachea operation on Saturday?
Very little, which is the way of the court. The Supreme Court is often very, very secretive about its operations, and I mean that figuratively and literally. And this is no exception. The fact that the Chief Justice had a tracheotomy, though, is generally considered by doctors we've spoken with to be not a good sign, to indicate that it is more serious than the most common type of thyroid cancer, which is generally quite treatable, and people do recover from it quite easily.
90-something percent recover, but not everyone.
No. But the most serious form of thyroid cancer, which this may be, because about 25% of those cases of the most serious kind require tracheotomies, and that is the survival rate is very dismal for that particular type of thyroid cancer.
Vivica, a very simple question. I don't know if you know the answer, but I know sometimes a tracheotomy actually takes away the patient's voice box.
Right.
Is that
right.
The case, or do we know?
We don't know. That's another thing we don't know. They're not telling us what type of thyroid cancer it is, what exactly the tracheotomy will mean for him. And this the part where they say he's going to be back on the bench Monday is really puzzling to people, because this is not, you know, the kind of, it's not outpatient surgery we're talking about here. And especially when you're 80 years old, you would think it would take a little more time to recover. So I expect we'll learn more in the next couple of days, but so far it's quite a mystery.
And what's the background here? This came out in a formal announcement from the Supreme Court mm-hmm. that he'd gone to the hospital on Friday, surgery on Saturday. Did his fellow members on the bench know this was coming? Do you know?
Don't know. It's unclear right now. There's a veil of secrecy over the Supreme Court that does not exist to that extent for the other two branches of government. So we know very little at this point. I'm hoping we'll learn more tomorrow.
But this has reminded us all that these are mortals like us all.
Exactly.
And not young ones in many cases.
Right. And you know, it's always been very difficult for candidates for the presidency to make the Supreme Court as significant as the Supreme Court, as we saw in 2000, and we see many other times. But it is often people try to raise this as an issue, and it does not go anywhere. So people say they care about it, but they almost never base their votes on it. But this is one time when it actually could become a real presidential campaign issue here in the last week. And I think that is to Kerry's benefit.
Well, give us a sense, Vivica Novak, if you could, of how the court and its potential resignations and appointments might play out in the next 4 years. What's the range of options that people talk about in Washington today?
Well, there almost certainly will be at least one, and there could be as many as four. I remember back in 2000 we were predicting that the next president could have as many as four appointments, and he's had none.
Right.
There have been none in 10 years. So it's an extraordinarily long time for there not to have been any resignations or departures from the court in one way or the other. And, you know, I think we can really feel safe this time in saying that there will be at least one departure. And, you know, people are making their lists, who are the most likely suspects on either side, and what are the confirmation fights going to look like under various scenarios, whether we have a Democrat or Republican in the White House and the Congress is Democratic or Republican. But I think we could have some really ferocious confirmation fights.
Do likely resignations depend on who wins? Are there people who will hang in there for the right time? Paint that picture for us.
Yes. Certainly some people will try to hang in. I think if John Kerry wins, you know, as many Republicans as can hang in will hang in. Now, you know, with Rehnquist's new health problems, perhaps he can't. But certainly he and Sandra Day O'Connor, we know, would prefer to resign under a Republican president to give him a chance to appoint somebody that was perhaps more like-minded. And as for Democrats, well, you know, it's hard to imagine John Paul Stevens going another 4 years.
He's now 84.
He's 84. But if George W. Bush wins, I think he will try to hang in there till the last possible minute. And, you know, those are the most likely departures that we'll see.
And what about Chief Justice Rehnquist himself? Unless this cancer was a complete surprise, he may have known about it for some time. There's no guarantee that George Bush will win next week. What's the logic? Why wouldn't he have stepped aside already, potentially, during a certain Republican presidency?
Well, if you've sort of noticed some of the fights we've had over some lower court judges, I think one of the reasons is that I think he was fairly confident, at least for a while, that Bush was going to win re-election. I think he does enjoy his job. He's reluctant to leave in a way. And I think that, you know, he when it gets towards the end of a president's term, certainly for the last year, it's difficult to imagine that Bush could have gotten practically anyone confirmed.
So there comes a point beyond which it just wouldn't work out. There's too many obstacles.
That's right.
Vivica Novak, thanks a lot for briefing us tonight.
It's good to be with you.
Much appreciated. Vivica Novak covers the Supreme Court for Time magazine. She spoke with me from Bethesda, Maryland. We are talking tonight about the Supreme Court stakes in the presidential election. I wonder, what do you think? Have war and terrorism pushed the Supreme Court issue off your screen as a voter? What kind of Supreme Court would you expect from a second Bush term, from a Kerry presidency? And what feels on the line for you personally as the Rehnquist Court ages? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Pamela Carlin. She's professor of law at Stanford University, director of the Stanford Supreme Court Clinic, which litigates cases in front of the Supreme Court. She's co-author of The Law of Democracy, Legal Structure of the Political Process. Pamela Carlin, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us from Chicago is John McGinnis, professor of law at Northwestern University and former deputy assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. John McGinnis, thank you for joining us.
Good evening.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
So let's just dive straight in here. Pamela Carlin, what do you see evolving here as we head into this vote on Tuesday? You get the news, as we all do, of the Chief Justice's thyroid cancer. What does it bring to mind for you? Do you expect a big turnover coming up here in both personnel and interpretation of the Constitution? How big a moment does it feel like to you?
Well, I think this is a big presidential election for some of the reasons that Vivica was talking about, which is this is a court that's been together a very long time. Traditionally, there's a turnover of at least one seat in each administration, and this administration hasn't had one yet. It's a court with a number of older members on it. I should say I argued a case in front of the Supreme Court in 1995, and Chief Justice Rehnquist wasn't on the bench that day because of health problems, so I wouldn't infer anything from these health problems about whether or when he would retire as opposed to one of the other justices. But this is a court that's been together a long time that is closely divided on a number of important issues. And depending on who is being replaced and by whom they're being replaced, you could expect to see some important shifts in the court's doctrine.
John McGinnis, a lot of 5-4 decisions here and the potential for significant turnover in the next 4 years. Do us a favor, take us through the issues that you would see as being most kind of on the line if the court membership changes.
Sure, I'll do that. I do think one thing that should be added, though, is there may be some less dramatic changes because of what's been going on in Washington, that almost certainly there'll be 40 Republicans or 40 Democrats in the Senate, and they've shown a willingness to filibuster nominees, and that
right.
will tend, as a political science matter, to move justices towards the middle, whether either Curry or Bush is elected.
Hard for anybody to put a real ideologue in there.
Yes, and I think that is different from the way it may have been 30 years ago. So I think that's very important to understand. Now, nevertheless, they obviously will choose very different kinds of judges. And I think the areas that are important are federalism. I think particularly if President Curry were to nominate judges, there's really 5-4 decisions in which the court has invigorated the distribution of power back to the states, decentralizing power, and that, I think, would be at risk. Another area that would be at risk under a perhaps under Curry-appointed justices would be permission for the states or the federal government to give school vouchers and include religious schools in those school vouchers. Again, a kind of decentralizing decision, giving power to the mediating institutions. Those would be, I think, important areas. Another a possible area that could be important would be the court has been closely divided on some campaign finance issues about how far Congress can regulate speech connected to a campaign. And I tend to think Justice Breyer, President Clinton's appointee, is a kind of the kind of appointee one would expect from President Curry, and he's been very much more sympathetic to allowing Congress to engage in that regulation. So those are three important areas that could change, particularly if Curry were elected.
And Pamela Karlan, of course, abortion is something that lots of people have their eye on from both sides of that argument. Do you see that on the line in a second Bush term? Could Roe v. Wade be overturned?
Well, I think Roe v. Wade itself is unlikely to be overturned. The question is what kinds of restrictions on abortions a Supreme Court would allow. So, for example, I don't think that it's likely you would see, unless you had a real sea change in the court, a court holding, for example, that abortion itself violates the Constitution or that a state's permitting abortions to occur would violate the Constitution. But you could imagine a whole lot of regulations and restrictions that would make it far more difficult for many women to obtain abortions that a more conservative court would uphold. I don't think there's any question about that.
And Jack Beatty, here we've got a picture of a fairly closely divided Congress that is at sword tips on judicial appointments right across the board. Both of our guests saying that there's a kind of moderating influence there on the appointments that either president could make.
Indeed. But one possibility is that, and not one that's much mentioned, and it's sort of thrown off by the abortion case, which of course is also is very interesting, is the growth of what some people call a sort of ideological movement among conservative legal thinkers to roll back the regulatory regime, really, of the progressive era, New Deal, and Great Society. These thinkers speak of, quote, the Constitution in exile, by which they mean the Constitution after the Constitutional Revolution of 1937 that essentially disallowed that allowed states and the federal government to regulate economic life, that's the illegitimate Constitution, and that the right one is the one from the Lochner era of the turn of the century, the laissez-faire outlook. Mm. Now, that would be a very huge change on the court, and some people, Justice Souter, for example, has warned of, quote, a return to the untenable jurisprudence from which the court extricated itself almost 60 years ago. He's warning precisely about a return to this sort of laissez-faire court under a new, if Bush were to be reelected and get his several appointees.
So new appointments could add up to a real challenge to the status quo in that case. I mean, we think of the court sort of always pushing in one direction. It could swing in an entirely different direction.
It could indeed, and these things have happened before, so especially with a new Chief Justice.
We've got a lot more to look at here. We're talking tonight about the Supreme Court stakes in next Tuesday's election. We're joined from Stanford by Pamela Carlin and from Northwestern University by John McGinnis. And our own Jack Beatty, you can join us as well. Have war and terrorism and job losses pushed the Supreme Court off your screen as a voter? How many justices can you imagine retiring in the next 4 years? Does it get your attention? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Supreme Court stakes in next Tuesday's election. On News Today, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, has thyroid cancer, had surgery over the weekend, tracheotomy, in fact. You can join the conversation tonight. What kind of Supreme Court would you expect to emerge from a second Bush term? What kind of America would emerge under a second term Bush court? And what if John Kerry wins? A status quo court or something else? What is at stake for American law, for American life, for American rights in Tuesday's election? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. During the second presidential debate, October 8th, in St. Louis, here's President Bush's response to a question about whom he would nominate to the Supreme Court.
I would pick somebody who would strictly interpret the Constitution of the United States. Let me give you a couple of examples, I guess, of the kind of person I wouldn't pick. I wouldn't pick a judge who said that the Pledge of Allegiance couldn't be said in a school because it had the words "under God" in it. I think that's an example of a judge allowing personal opinion to enter into the decision-making process as opposed to strict interpretation of the Constitution.
And here's how Senator John Kerry responded to the same question.
I don't believe we need a good conservative judge, and I don't believe we need a good liberal judge. I don't believe we need a good judge of that kind of definition on either side. I subscribe to the Justice Potter Stewart standard. He was a justice on the Supreme Court of the United States. And he said the mark of a good judge, good justice, is that when you're reading their decision, their opinion, you can't tell if it's written by a man or a woman, a liberal or a conservative, a Muslim, a Jew, or a Christian. You just know you're reading a good judicial decision.
Senator Kerry on his view on appointments to the High Court, the Supreme Court. We're joined tonight by Pamela Carlin from Stanford and John McGinnis from Northwestern University. Pamela, I wish you'd dive in here for a second on President Bush's comments and do some interpretation for us. He says he wants justices who strictly interpret the Constitution of the United States and then more. But is this what Jack Beatty was talking about before the break? Is this going back, pushing regulation off the table? What's implied with that?
Well, I actually think he's getting at something a little bit different there, which is the words strict construction have long been thought to be conservative words. But in fact, if you took a very literal interpretation of the Constitution, it would be hard to have done the kind of states' rights / federalism cases that John McGinnis was talking about, because they involve subtracting and adding words to the 11th Amendment of the Constitution. Mm. I think what he's really getting at there is a signal to his base, and you saw this more in the other debate where he said what he didn't like about the Supreme Court were the justices of the Dred Scott era, which is a thinly coded reference in some ways to the abortion issue.
Because he's saying they supported slavery, that was a mistake.
They supported slavery, and that's like abortion.
The court has supported abortion, that is also a mistake.
Exactly. And just to give an example that I think is kind of interesting, you know, when he points to the Pledge of Allegiance case, the judge on the Ninth Circuit who wrote that decision was actually appointed by Richard Nixon many, many, many years ago. And one of the things to keep in mind when you think about the Supreme Court and the elections is Chief Justice Rehnquist was also appointee of Richard Nixon. So the half-life, or the longevity of justices, means that a presidential administration can have real effects 20 or 30 years after the president leaves office. I don't think anybody thought, when any of the justices on the Supreme Court today, for example, were appointed, to ask them anything about how they thought the Constitution should be interpreted in a time of terror, because in 1993, 1994, 1981, when these justices were being appointed, no one thought that was a pressing constitutional issue. And so it's important to keep in mind that In the short run, we can think about what the justices are likely to do with the kinds of cases we already know about. But in the longer run, it's hard to know what kinds of cases will crop up 10 or 15 or 20 years from now.
But that underlying impulse of the justices is pretty important. Rehnquist, you know, putting a fist through the wall between church and state, Dahlia Lithwick writes today during his time. And, of course, on the issue of federalism, strong underlying positions. John McGinnis, look at John Kerry's response to that question. Says he doesn't believe we need a good conservative judge or a good liberal judge. He goes for the Justice Potter rule. What do you make? What's he saying there?
Well, I think he's frankly trying myself to avoid the issue of judging, which is really, of course, not conservative versus liberal, in that he's correct, but of judicial philosophy of how one should interpret the Constitution. Should one interpret it according to the original meaning of the Constitution? And in general, there's some view, and I don't say always, if that's the way the justices now likely to be appointed by Republicans like Scalia and Thomas tend to interpret the Constitution, or those who want to interpret the Constitution according to some more evolving standards. Obviously, Roe versus Wade and the whole privacy line of cases are cases which really are read in to the Constitution, in which there are moral principles, and many people think that's important to keep the Constitution up to date. And that is the real division. So I think in discussing that there's no liberal or no conservative judge, in that sense he's correct, but I'm not sure he's addressing the real issue, which is there are very different interpretive philosophies, and they are now associated with the Democratic and Republican parties.
I want to get this down to a nitty-gritty level. Jack Beatty, help us if you can, that reporters, that voters can understand when they're headed into the voting booth next week about exactly what the consequences might be. Pamela Carlin points out you can have very long-term sort of big arc issues, but there could be more immediate things as well. What's on your short list, Jack, of hot issues that a change of one or two or three justices could mean a real change in American life and law?
Well, I suspect that eventually these laws and referenda, putting anti-gay amendments into state constitutions and so on, that there's going to be a 14th Amendment challenge to them at the Supreme Court level. And that will be a great moment for American liberty. And for this court, it will put it in a somewhat of a position of tension with one of its past decisions, that one in the sodomy, the Texas case recently, where it upheld sexual expression as a, quote, form of liberty. The court warned there that didn't necessarily apply to gay marriage. But many people think, or at least some people think, that the logic is there to say we protected equal protection of the rights applies to sexual expression. It should also apply to marriage. So that would be a very big case, it seems to me, affecting the lives of lots of people. And beyond that, there are environmental cases where a takings clause, which is something the conservatives talk about, where government can take over things for the sake of the environment or regulate for the sake of the environment. These kinds of things, which can affect people, could be on the ballot because of the evolution of environmental regulation and the suits against it and so on. So I think that you could get stuff in there. And I think that also this court has shown a willingness to override Congress. And that has, again, that is a tendency that one doesn't know where that would lead. Congress is the elected branch. And in the past, the court respected the political branch. But there has been a tendency with this court in several decisions to overrule acts of Congress. And, well, that could be a very effective break on any sort of social legislation from the Congress, it seems to me. And that's even without changing the current composition of the court.
And depending on the complexion of the future, could be even a stronger break. Pamela Carlin, what about a couple of other 5-4 issues? We've seen that the current court race on affirmative action, 5-4 support there, upholding in the University of Michigan case, religion, this gradual Rehnquist court lowering of the barrier between church and state, that could be turned around or made more pronounced.
Well, I think that's right. On both of those issues, the court can shift from case to case. So, for example, the court upheld the University of Michigan Law School's affirmative action plan, but struck down the University of Michigan undergraduate plan. And you could see the next case going up being about, for example, voluntary desegregation plans in elementary and secondary schools. Or you could see a question whether a state could use affirmative action in government employment as well as in admission to elite educational institutions. And the court might well come out a different way, depending on what the membership of the court is. The same thing is true in a lot of the establishment and free exercise clause cases, cases involving religion, that a lot of times the court shifts its position from case to case depending on the facts and how it sees those facts. And so you could easily see a different court deciding either to allow various kinds of assistance to parochial schools that this court hasn't allowed, or to forbid states from not giving aid to parochial schools if they're giving it to regular private schools, which was an issue that was at the court last year. So you can imagine cases coming up that would be decided quite differently in areas of race, religion, sexual orientation. You could imagine all of those things being quite different depending on when the case arrives in front of the court and whom is on the court at that time.
And there's more I want to hear about Roe v. Wade and abortion, but let's get some callers in here first. Philip is calling from Whitewater, Wisconsin. Hi, Philip. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if you guys would comment on the fact that once these guys are nominated and approved by the Senate, in many cases, they become remarkably independent. I mean, that could be because they change their minds or because they're influenced by other members of the court, or because they evolve over time and they're not nearly as liberal or conservative as the people who nominated them thought they would be. An example of that might be Earl Warren, who was something of a disappointment to a lot of conservatives, it seems to me. Try to predict what these guys are going to do, you'd be better off trying to bet on the horse track.
it can be tricky business. That's clear, Philip. Thanks for the call. Let us pick it up. John McGinnis, David Souter was that kind of disappointment, I think, for President Bush's father.
Yes, and one doesn't end with David Souter. Of course, the Republicans have appointed most of the justices since President Nixon. The Democrats have only appointed Justice Ginsburg and Breyer, and yet this does not is not a a very conservative court in many ways, as in on the abortion matter. And I think that's true. And I think that actually is a point that should be borne in mind, that it, really the whole legal culture helps determine how the Supreme Court comes out. And I think our legal culture in general leans more to the liberal side. And so there will be a current against which even conservative justices generally are going to swim, even if they are selected to the court. And that's another effect on the court that I think is likely to be there, even if President Bush is appointing justices, that we have a structure of law, which leans somewhat to the left, is represented by our leading law schools, where there really are almost all liberal critics. We might call them the theater critics of Supreme Court decisions.
But those aren't the guys that President Bush has been appointing to lower courts. I mean, if the Democrats, if there's any merit to their cries, they make a lot of noise about what they describe as ideological Bush nominations to the lower courts. John McGinnis, do you see a different crop that's likely to be waiting to be named to the Supreme Court that's more right-leaning than we've seen in recent decades?
I don't think we're certainly going to see more right-leaning, as I said, because of the large representation of Democrats and their willingness to filibuster. We're likely to see pretty moderate justices. And what I think happens in general to moderate justices is that there are these strong currents of the legal establishment which move pretty strongly in the liberal direction. And so I think that is a strong check on any ability of a Republican administration to remake the Supreme Court.
Pamela Carlin, do you share that view?
No, I actually disagree with it. I think one of the big shifts over the last, say, 30 years is a shift within the Republican Party, which used to have a moderate to liberal wing that was centered in the Northeast and a more conservative wing. And so if you ask, would Gerald Ford be disappointed by the voting record, say, of John Paul Stevens? I'm not sure he would be. If you ask, would Ronald Reagan be terribly disappointed overall by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's record, I would say no. Now, there are some issues on which she is to the left of President Reagan, but there are a lot of issues on which she's carried out very much the kind of legal philosophy that I think the people who nominated her to the Supreme Court would have expected.
But you're saying there's a new Republican profile in power now?
Yes, I think the Republican Party today does not have the same sort of balance that the Republican Party would have had 20 years ago. It has moved very far, I think, to the right. And so you wouldn't have somebody in the White House today nominating somebody like David Souter, who was a moderate Republican from New Hampshire. That kind of Republican is really no longer, I think, part of the governing body of the Republican Party. And I think you will see some attempts to name some people who are very far to the right. The question whether the Democrats can stop some of them or stop all of them is a very real question. You know, for all of the discussion of the Democratic filibusters, more of President George W. Bush's nominees to the courts of appeals have been approved than were approved during the Clinton administration, and much more quickly. There are only 10 people who haven't been approved, and there are around, I think, about 200 who have been.
People have been pretty dug in for a while. Sean is calling from Medway, Massachusetts. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I'm a recent law school graduate a couple of years ago. I took a couple of classes on Supreme Court history, and something I think that's really important to keep in mind is that despite the fact the court changes or seems to change its opinion from time to time based on the facts of the case, there are a lot of times where you have a decision that has far-reaching aspects, not just in the legal community, but on people's lives.
What are you thinking of, Sean?
Well, someone before mentioned the Lochner case, which essentially kept the government out of economic regulation for 30-some-odd years. You can go back as to the 1800s and cite things such as Dred Scott and Plessy v. Ferguson, which had significant impacts on individual people's lives. And sometimes when I think the general public looks at the court, that kind of gets lost in the shuffle.
Sean, are you concerned that a new court could eventually change fundamental understanding of what the Constitution promises Americans, or are we on a sort of progressive path here?
Well, I would like to think that we're on a progressive path, but I think it really depends on what kind of justices and what their ideologies are that are being appointed to the court. Obviously, there was a point in time where things like Lochner were held in high regard by the justices, and times like that have changed. But who's to say it can't go back to being that way?
Sean, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, there's a kind of alternating current here. On the one hand, we're hearing, well, there are brakes on appointing anybody who's too radically in one direction or another. On the other hand, as you point out, and Sean, our caller, points out, there can be large swings over time that really can change things.
Yes, and you know, I'm not an expert on judicial culture, but just contra Professor McGinnis, I mean, there is now, according to an excellent article by Jeff Rosen a couple of years ago in the New York Times Magazine, there is now a very substantial legal counterculture, if you will, for conservatives. Based in the Federalist Society, based on the federal bench, especially in Virginia and elsewhere, there are, and in the law schools, there are brilliant justice judges and legal and law professors who, as I say, and as our caller just raised, really take a very different view about the role of the federal government in American life. And they have a friend on the court. They have two of them, in Scalia and Thomas. So it isn't as if the culture is strictly liberal. There's a very strong conservative culture with a lot of intellectual firepower to it.
There's more we want to hear tonight. We're talking about the Supreme Court stakes in next Tuesday's election. You can join the conversation. What is at stake for American law, American life, American rights in Tuesday's election? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Supreme Court stakes in next Tuesday's election. They could be very substantial. We're joined tonight from Stanford University by Pamela Carlin, from Northwestern University in Chicago by John McGinnis. Jack Beatty's with us. You can join us as well. How important is the makeup of the court in your vote for president? And if the court is in play, which way would you like to see it move? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is calling from Crab Orchard, Kentucky. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
First, I want to say thank you for a talk radio with a brain.
You're most welcome. What's on your mind, Michael?
I'm concerned if Bush is reelected that the states' rights will continue to outweigh civil rights. Particularly, I'm concerned about handicap access to governmental facilities. I've heard and seen, I can't recall the exact case the Supreme Court ruled on, where a handicapped individual had to climb upstairs by his hand.
Right, a huge case with major implications for public buildings and some private all over the country.
Yes, and I'm concerned that that will become more of a problem.
Well, let's pick it up specifically. John McGinnis, let's just take that one as an example. Do you see this fitting into the states' rights issue? Could you imagine?
Tennessee versus Lane, I think he's talking about, and that was a case actually the court held that Congress did have the power under Section 5 because this was a fundamental right to legislate on this issue. So actually that specific issue the court ruled his way. More generally, I think it's important not to just look at this as sort of rights of states, but as rights of people to govern themselves in a decentralized way. And the hard question under Section 5 is how far does Congress's power extend? And what the court seems to be moving towards is allow the Congress a lot of leeway in using the Section 5 power in race, and in gender and in things like fundamental rights, but not allowing it to pass legislation on any subject at once, because otherwise you're not going to allow states to make those decisions. And that's really an advantage to democracy, because you're having local decision-making, local rules that can compete among themselves to see what are better. I mean,
but of course, you know the history there, and of course how states' rights was also used to protect some practices that we now consider kind of really wholly unacceptable. Can you see a pendulum swing strong enough that some of the kind of social arrangements that Americans have become accustomed to could once again be ruled out of bounds by a Supreme Court or by states and protected?
Section 5, of course, contemplates and is was used to enforce the Civil Rights Act with respect to race. The question is, how far are you going to allow a Congress to make this a kind of general power by which it is going to regulate the relations on really all sorts of grounds, not just race and gender, among people in the states? And there are costs to that. There are costs to decentralization. It's not a matter of the rights of states, but the fact that people themselves have an advantage in having different kinds of rules and seeing how they compete with one another. We're stronger as a nation with that kind of more decentralized system in many areas of social life.
Jack Beattie, there's a very appealing way of looking at states' rights, if you will, or more local rights, as John McGinnis puts it, and yet there's the history where that was a pretty tough barrier for some civil rights advances.
It certainly was, and also for people with handicaps. The court ruled in, I think it was a New Jersey case, I'm not sure recently, that the Americans with Disabilities Act did not apply to state governments. And for people with disabilities who work for state governments and local governments, that was I think that's the kind of thing Michael was talking about. That was on the one hand, a curbing of the power of Congress. On the other hand, you could say that fundamental rights to equal protection of the laws were denied to handicapped people.
Dan is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Dan. You're on the air. Hello, Dan. Are you there?
Yeah, Dean Hoskins.
You're on the air, my friend.
Oh, okay. Thanks for the open platform, folks. I'm concerned about how a Bush-appointed court would react or treat the provision in the Patriot II Act of allowing the government to detain Americans and stripping them of their constitutional rights to an attorney and so forth.
The kind of civil liberties question. Dan, let us run with that. Pamela Carlin, lots could come up on that side in the next 4 years. How do you see it playing out if it's a Bush or Kerry administration, if they've got one or two or who knows, three appointments? Can you see a very different interpretation of civil liberties emerging?
Well, you can certainly imagine very, very different interpretations of civil liberties emerging. This is one issue, though, on which I'm not sure that the traditional left-right distinction is the only one there. I mean, if you look at, for example, last term's cases at the Supreme Court, in particular the Hamdi case, which involved the detention of an American citizen, and the administration's position was, we can detain him. We decide whether he's an enemy alien. There should be no review by a court anywhere. And, you know, Justice Thomas said that was fine by him. He thought that sort of thing should be left to the executive branch without any real oversight by the courts or anyone else, whereas Justice Scalia took a very different view. In fact, it was one of those cases that a lot of people think of as an odd couple case, because the left wing of the court in that case was made up of Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens, who took the position the Constitution's absolutely clear. You can try someone for treason. You can have a general suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, which I don't think the government is likely to do anytime soon. No. Or you have to let this person go. There isn't some sort of executive detention power in the federal government. So a lot of it depends not just on whether somebody's generally liberal or generally conservative, but on how they read the Constitution. And this gets back to the point that John McGinnis was making earlier, that jurisprudential approaches can sometimes lead judges, both on the right and on the left, to decisions that you wouldn't predict.
Hard to stereotype there. Mm.
It isn't necessarily true that you can pinpoint stereotypically whether somebody who's a liberal will consistently decide all cases in one direction any more than you can for a conservative. So I think what you're looking for is some sense of what a person's jurisprudential approach is going to be. How open-minded are they to listening to the arguments? How careful are they? I mean, a lot of this is a question of whether the person is so clouded by ideology or so clouded by inability that he or she won't do a good job, as well as what the person's approach is.
I want to try and get one more call. Barbara's calling from Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, what happens if we lose Rehnquist? And what happens if Kerry is indeed nominated or elected
on November 2nd?
Tuesday. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got 2 months that Bush is still in office. Could he, by any chance, put somebody else in there?
Got it, Barbara. Thanks. John McGinnis, is there any shortcut to putting someone on the Supreme Court? Does it have to go through the full dress Senate approval process?
Yes, there is a shortcut. But it only works for a brief period of time, and that's called the recess appointment clause. Should Rehnquist leave, be forced to leave by ill health during the period where there may be a recess, it is generally the executive branch over a long time, for many presidents, has asserted they have the right during a recess of the Senate to appoint a justice. But then he would only be able, because there is a actual clause in the Constitution that gives them that authority, he would only serve to the end of the next session of Congress, and he would only serve if no other justice were nominated and confirmed to that seat. So it's a very limited authority, not really to put someone on the bench for life, which is really, as Professor Carlin suggests, the real power of a nomination of the court to deal with issues far in the future.
Jack Beatty, so many elements on a voter's mind going into that voting booth next week, from the economy to terrorism to war in Iraq, and here the Supreme Court, it's really a groaning board of things to consider.
It is, and those services for life, that really matters. I mean, John Adams' Federalism Lost in 1800, but it lived on for 30 years with Chief Justice Marshall. You know, in 2000, we said the election would decide the court. It said the court decided the election. But this time, I think, is different just because of the actuarial tables with these justices. So something big is at stake. And, you know, when he appointed Justice Holmes, Theodore Roosevelt said to him, you know, you work for corporations, but you've never killed the sympathy for the fellow at the bottom. That's what I want in a judge.
Well, we hear that vote, and we can imagine William Rehnquist's mind tonight, 80 years old, dealing with thyroid cancer. Time waits for no man or woman. Pamela Carlin at Stanford, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And John McGinnis at Northwestern University, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jack, thanks for being on board.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the political stars come out on the campaign trail. This is On Point. With the election just 8 days away now, George Bush and John Kerry today enlisted the help of some heavy hitters. The president campaigned in Greeley, Colorado, with former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani at his side. John Kerry appeared in Philadelphia with Bill Clinton, the first time the former president has emerged on the campaign trail since his heart surgery 7 weeks ago. Clinton appeared a little slimmer than before his surgery, but he was feisty on the stump. He blasted President Bush for huge budget deficits and lost jobs. Giuliani, meanwhile, told a raucous crowd that a second Bush administration would mean a safer America. Tonight we bring you both candidates, all-star pitchmen, beginning with Rudolph Giuliani introducing President Bush in Colorado.
We're engaged in an effort against terrorism that they began when they attacked us on September 11, 2001. And under President Bush, we have made certain that we go on offense against them. And to make certain we continue to remain on offense, we need to reelect President Bush and Vice President Cheney. We can't take a chance in going back to where we were before September 11, 2001, with someone who can't seem to make up his mind whether terrorism is serious or a nuisance. And we need to reelect President Bush and Vice President Cheney to make sure that our economy recovers. We've had the strongest recovery in the last 13 months than we've had in 20 or 30 years, and that's because of the policies of President Bush and Vice President Cheney that his opponent would jeopardize. So let's make certain that we reelect him for 4 more years. So I thank you very much for being here. It is my great honor to present to you our great president and soon to be our reelected president, George W. Bush.
That was former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani introducing President Bush today in Greeley, Colorado. Now here's former President Bill Clinton introducing John Kerry in Philadelphia.
I am proud that John Kerry has treated the voters of America with genuine respect. He's given them his specific plans on jobs, on health care, on energy, on security. In the closing days of this election, and you know I've been home watching it, so I see all this stuff. The other side, they're trying to scare the undecided voters about Senator Kerry. And they're trying to scare the decided voters away from the polls. We know about that, don't we? It works so well in Florida, they seem to be trying it elsewhere. In the closing days of this campaign, John Kerry has gone on being John Kerry, talking about his hopes for America, his plans for America, his commitment to our security and our prosperity. Now, one of Clinton's laws of politics is this. If one candidate's trying to scare you, and the other one's trying to get you to think, if one candidate's appealing to your fears and the other one's appealing to your hopes, you better vote for the person that wants you to think and hope. That's the best. My fellow Americans, we can do better. And in 8 days, we're going to do better with President John Kerry. Bring him on.
Former President Bill Clinton, back from heart surgery, campaigning today for John Kerry in Philadelphia, and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani stumping for George Bush in Greeley, Colorado. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.